These are magnetic fields above active regions on the sun. There are sunspots down there. This is the general magnetic field of the sun. The north magnetic pole is near the north pole of the sun, and the south magnetic pole is near the south pole of the sun, or else the other way around. The north magnetic pole is near the south pole of the sun, and vice versa. It flips every 11 years or so with every new solar activity cycle. The things you're seeing here in the middle, this was taken with yet another exposure, and that is the moon. That is the disk of the moon. It is blue because it is lighted up by the full Earth, which is shining onto it, and which is intensely blue as a result of that scattering of the atmosphere reflected on the oceans. So you are seeing something here that you will not see with the eye, because the brightness of the corona drowns out the disk of the moon with the eye. In fact, to me, in 1970, the disk of the moon was brownish, and that's got to be a psychological effect. It should actually be bluish. You can just barely make out geographic features on the moon. There is Mare Imbrium, there is Mare Conchoitatis, right there is the Apollo 11 landing site, and so forth. And the contrast is pretty low, but you can see it if you know what to look for. But this is something that can be seen only in this photograph. Well, this gives a little bit of a hint of the magnificence of the corona, but you still have no idea from these pictures of this magnificent lighting that you have all around the landscape. This is a picture of the corona which was taken from Skylab. In space, you can do something you cannot do on the Earth, and that is generate an artificial eclipse by simply putting a metal disc over the photosphere, and this is the out-of-focus image of the rod which holds the metal disc. Try to do that on the surface of the Earth, and what you will get is the blue sky around the sun, which drowns out the corona entirely. But since there's no air in space, you can see the corona. Well, we learned tremendous amounts about the corona from Skylab. It revolutionized their knowledge of the solar corona, in fact, of the sun in general. But this is a very special picture. This was taken just before a total eclipse of the sun, which was visible on Earth, and that is the moon. It's the only time you're ever going to see a new moon. People think new moon means crescent. It does not. New moon means the time when the moon is so between us and the Earth and the sun that you see none of its lighted side whatsoever. You see only the shattered hemisphere. Incidentally, the term dark side is often incorrectly used for the hemisphere of the moon that is away from the Earth. That is not correct. That hemisphere gets lighted up by the sun half the time, just like our hemisphere. And in fact, at this moment, the hemisphere away from the Earth is obviously totally lighted up by the sun. So don't use the term dark side for that. Far side is the correct term. Here is a picture taken with a fisheye lens at the 1970 eclipse. This one was in Jalapa, Mexico, with a very badly overexposed image of the sun. That's Venus. You can see the brightest of the stars and planets in daytime, but only the very brightest because there is enough light in the sky. And this gives you a faint hint of this magnificent coloration that you get all through the sky. What's happening is let's show you another picture first, which is not as large a portion of the sky, but the colors are a little bit more light. And what you have is a beautiful salmon-colored layer ring around the horizon, and then it is quite dark overhead. This is the shadow of the moon. Let's see if I can show you why this is happening and what exactly is going on here. If I go back to the overhead projector, I think I can make it clear. Here you are on the Earth. Here is the atmosphere of the Earth. And it is not too bad an approximation to simply draw a line and say that's the top of the atmosphere. Because the Earth's atmosphere is very severely concentrated towards the surface, simply by its own weight. Half of the air of the Earth is within 3 miles of the surface. And so if you have been in a jet plane, as far as your body is concerned, you have been in space. You could not have breathed the atmosphere outside your cabin window. It's too thin. And now all of a sudden you understand what those deliberately vague oxygen mask demonstrations are about. The steward is hoping you aren't going to know what is meant by the term. In the unlikely event of a sudden loss of cabin pressure, in other words, if the artificial air that is being maintained inside the cabin should suddenly be lost and you need to get hold by a meteorite or something and you lose a window, then all of a sudden you're going to have air outside that's too thin to breathe. It's also bitterly cold. And so the pilot will do a crash dive down to a lower altitude, but meanwhile, you've got to do something. The passenger's going to lose consciousness in about 30 seconds if you don't. And so the stewardess tries to convince you that an oxygen mask will automatically come down if they should happen. Maybe well, I don't know, I've never had experience, fortunately. Okay, so the Earth's atmosphere is pretty well concentrated towards the surface, and I'm going to approximate it by just saying there's a top edge there. Here you are, standing on the Earth, looking up at the sun, and here is the shadow of the moon, which is a cone, but the angle of that cone is very narrow, it's only 1.5 degrees, so it's practically a cylinder. Okay, what's happening is, as you look up at the sun, all of your view path is shadowed, and so it appears dark around the sun. If you look in this direction, say, you find that although eventually your line of sight will get into sunlit air, by then the air is so thin that you're not going to see anything. And so that direction appears dark as well. But if you look out in this direction, you are able to see out to the sunlit air outside the boundary of the umbra. And since the air is not 100% transparent, there is sunlight which is coming down and being bounced off air molecules in that direction and coming into you. And so what happens is you see a dark portion of the sky. There's a certain circle, not necessarily centered on the sun, which is this portion here, which is dark. And then there is a ring around the horizon where you are able to see the sunlit air outside the shadow. And of course, the light has to travel several miles to reach you through that, along that those light paths. And so the air, the light is well scattered out, and what you get when you look in those directions is the sun, is roughly the same color that you used to at the sunset, but not the same exactly because the geometry is different. The light is coming from a different angle. That is the physics of it. Of course, it gets much more complicated because there is a time when the shadow is just moving towards you like this, and there is a time when it's just moving away from you like this. And so where on the horizon is darkest and where is brightest and that kind of thing varies during the seasons of totality. But what this physics does not convey to you is the magnificence of the sight. What I would do if I were you is take a is not try to take any pictures if you don't see the eclipse, because totality is so short that you are going to find that there is no way you can both see it and photograph it. You will be able to buy slides a few months after the event. They'll be advertised in the Sky and Telescope, taken with equipment that's better than yours. So why miss the eclipse in order to get poorer pictures of your own? What I would suggest doing, though, especially if you have a really wide-angle lens or better yet a fisheye, is try to get some pictures of this landscape coloration. For some reason, it's very seldom photographed. And that is one that would be truly unique. Here is a picture of something that you might see at the end of the eclipse, or you might see at the beginning. This is the diamond ring. What's happening is there is one place there on the moon where it happens to be especially low. There's a little valley there or something, a little notch between two crater walls, who knows what. And a little bit, a tiny bit of photosphere is shining through that. This picture doesn't give you any idea what it looks like to the eye. It looks like a big blob there because it's badly overexposed. What in fact it is an intensely brilliant little star. You may see a number of them, in fact, along the edge, either at the beginning or the end, and those are called Bailey's beads. But very often what happens is one Bailey's bead is especially prominent. That happens to be the deepest valley at whatever edge of the, whatever portion of the moon happens to be at the edge at that particular moment. So you have one really intense little star there, one Bailey's bead, and then the inner corona is still visible. It hasn't been completely drowned out. So that is called the diamond ring for obvious reasons. There, by the way, is a prominence. As soon as you see the Bailey's beads, look away. That means the photosphere is coming back. But as long as the photosphere is completely covered and only the chromosphere and or corona are visible, it is perfectly safe to look at the sun for as long as you want, through your naked eye, through camera finders, through binoculars, through telescopes, through anything. Just make sure that you have got them in such a way that as soon as the photosphere comes back, you can move them off the sun. Don't leave the telescope set up there pointing at the sun and take a risk of cracking your eyepiece as soon as the photosphere comes back, or take a risk of some little kid coming over and not knowing any better and looking through it and blinding himself for life. That kind of thing could ruin your whole day. You don't want it to happen. Well, here's a picture which sums up the whole thing. This was again taken at Oaxaca, Mexico in 1970, and as the sun moved across the sky due to the rotation of the Earth, the photographer took a picture every 7 minutes. And here on the same film, live cameras you can't do this with. You can't make deliberate multiple exposures, but on this one he did. And this is a standard cliche kind of picture that everybody takes. It's prettier if you get something in the foreground with the sun that's low in the sky. You'll be able to do so. This 1970 eclipse was higher up in the sky. So you see more and more of the sun being covered up by the moon. There is a moment of totality, and then more and more of it being uncovered like so. Now, here are pictures of an annular eclipse, just to show you what it looked like. This was a very special annular eclipse that happened in 1951, and these pictures were taken by Ralph Dakin in North Carolina from a location where the annularly eclipsed sun rose. And so you have the sunrise color and the flattening of the disk due to the atmosphere near the horizon, with the incredible addition of the fact that it's an annular eclipse of the sun. Here are pictures of the moon's shadow on the Earth taken in 1970 by the satellite ATS-3, 22,000 miles out. And they are most intense where you see them over clouds. Of course, the people on the ground are not appreciating the fact that the satellite is getting an especially good view of the shadow there, since they aren't. But this is what it looks like. And you can see the umbra you're seeing the umbra there in the inner penumbra, and there is Florida sticking out, there's the Yucatan Peninsula and so forth, and there are the clouds which cover a good part of the United States. If you were right there in Norfolk, Virginia, as I was, you got a good view. If you were down there in Georgia, which was predicted to be the place where the weather would be the best, unfortunately, you did not get a good view. The eclipse track for that eclipse went right across here like this. Happens on other planets as well. Here are pictures taken by Viking Orbiter 1 of the shadow of the Martian moon Phobos as it moved directly across Viking Lander 1. These pictures, the uppermost and the last, were taken only 2 minutes apart. Phobos is close into Mars, it moves fast, but it's small enough that were you on Viking Lander 1 looking up at the sun, you would not have seen a total eclipse, you would have seen only an annular eclipse. A very strange one, because Phobos is not even approximately spherical, and so you would have seen this irregular outline against the edge of the sun. Now, here is what the eclipse track looked like, and what I want to do now is introduce you to the geography involved. The black outline is the region in which partial eclipse is visible, and the red line is the region from which total eclipse is visible. And remember, you don't want to be just anywhere in that red area. You want to be along the central line. The central line comes onshore at just about the boundary between Washington and Oregon, and then goes on up through Idaho and Montana and North Dakota, as I described, and as you will see in much more detail in the maps that are down here in the front. Let's introduce you a little bit to the geography of the eclipse track. We've got the map there, so instead of showing you maps, I'm going to show you Skylab slides. Here is a view of much of the track taken by Skylab 4 in the winter, just about at the time of the year when the eclipse is going to happen, and I think you see the problem, all those clouds. You're looking east here. This is Puget Sound, and Seattle and Tacoma are right down there at the end of it. Here are the Olympic Mountains with snow on them, and you notice there is a trench in between the coastal ranges, such as the Olympic Mountains. This is the shoreline here, and there is what's the name of that cape?
Anybody know?
Cape Flattery? Okay, there's Cape Flattery like so, and so there's the Straits of Juan de Fuca, and here is the southern tip of Vancouver Island. And you'll notice that they're in between the coast ranges and the Cascades, which is this line of mountains here, and which includes the great volcanoes like Mount Rainier and Mount Hood and so forth, there is a trench, which in fact extends all the way down the Pacific coast, broken only a few places. It's occupied by Puget Sound, it's occupied by this portion of the Columbia River, the place where it curves there, the up at the northwest boundary of Oregon, and it's occupied further south by the Sacramento and San Joaquin Valleys in California. Then you have a line of mountains, which are the Cascades. Then you have another lowland, not a trench, but a wider region, and that theoretically might be in the precipitation shadow of these two ranges of mountains. And so theoretically, that might be the best place to be. But as you see, you know, as Robert Heinlein says, climate is what you expect and weather is what you get. climate is just statistics. And the day when this picture was taken, you would have been better off to be out there at the coast, where any Washingtonian or Oregonian would tell you is the worst place because it's fog there. Be careful also when you get inland that you be in a relatively high place, or else if you're down one of the river valleys, for example, if you're in Spokane, you're likely to get low-lying ground fog just the result of being in the river valley. So you want to be in a relatively high place in the plateau region as close to the foot of the Cascades as you can get, because that precipitation shadow is not terribly wide. The Cascades aren't really all that high. Then on the other side of this low stretch, you have, far over on the other side, you have the Rockies. Here is a view taken in spring from directly down of the same area. There is Cape Flattery, here's the southern tip of Vancouver Island, Straits of Juan de Fuca. This is Puget Sound, Seattle, Tacoma are there. The northern boundary of the Eclipse Track runs right through here. And there are the Olympic Mountains, and here's the trench, and here are the Cascades. And actually, where you want to be is just beyond, the central line is just beyond, I'm sorry, I'm doing this wrong, here's the Columbia. The central line runs right through there. Here is a closer view of the Cascades, a more detailed view, I should say, taken with a very complex false color process, 13 different stages using black and white pictures taken through different filters on Skylab. The purpose of it was that when they finally finish all this process, all of the areas where there's been clear-cut logging show up as purple. It's an example of the kind of thing you can do with space photography. But what I wanted to show you in this picture is that there is a series of volcanoes there, andesitic volcanoes. That means they're made of a particular kind of rock called andesite, similar to the volcanoes in the Andes, which is where the name comes from. This one is Mount St. Helens, and a lot of the famous mountains in the northwest are that way. Mount Rainier, which is about two-thirds of the way from the center to the edge, to the north edge of the Eclipse Track, so just north of where you want to be, is one of them. Mount Hood is another, Mount Shasta is another, and so forth. Mount Rainier is the major one that's in the Eclipse Track. Mount St. Helens here is in it also. The Eclipse Track runs almost through the middle of this picture. Now, as you get east of the Cascades, you run into semi-desert land such as this. You can see it's quite badly eroded. And where it's been irrigated, there are a lot of farms, but elsewhere it's quite dry. This is a false color infrared picture, and you can see these circular patches which are cropping up all over the west these days. That's center pivot irrigation. You have a giant lawn sprinkler which very slowly is rotated around a central point, and it sprays where it goes, but it goes in a circle. This is the Columbia River. And the city called the Dalles is in there, although I don't remember the geography well enough to tell you where, and you can't see it. But the point that I'm trying to show you is this is a desert area. There is the east edge of the Cascades, and somewhere in here probably would be a fairly good place to be. The central line runs just about through the middle of this picture. North is in the upper left corner. A bit further east than that, you have the channeled scablands, which are one of the most incredible geologic stories that I know. The north edge runs right about through the middle of the scablands, and Spokane is in there somewhere. These are enormous valleys, which are, in some cases, tens of miles across. This picture is 115 miles on a side. It was taken from 575 miles up by Landsat 1, and the scabland channels are clearly visible. They were formed in a few days as the result of the greatest flood that is known in the entire geologic history of the Earth. During the retreat of the last glacier, to be exact 18,000 years ago, there was a glacial dam which plugged the Clark Fork of the Columbia River, and despite its name, that's a major river, the Clark Fork itself is. And the water backed up to form a lake fully comparable in size to one of the smaller of our present Great Lakes. But it's called Lake Missoula, and you can trace it all the way back to Missoula, Montana, and a good deal farther than that. And it was held only by this glacial dam. And so one fine spring day, I should imagine, the dam gave way, and the entire lake emptied over the surrounding countryside with a flow of 9 cubic miles per hour, which is estimated as 10 times the combined flow of all the rivers on all the Earth put together. And that flow, in 3 days, eroded channels hundreds of feet deep and tens of miles in width into the solid rock of the Columbia Plateau, which is what both the rock here and the rock underlying that last picture, everything between the Cascades and the Rockies in this particular latitude, is made of. It's an enormous flow of lava, 200,000 square miles of it, very much like the Maria on the moon. We talked about the basalt flows that may exist on Venus earlier. It's the same sort of thing that I'm talking about. This is a good Earth example of that kind of thing. These channels are what they call the coulees. Everybody's heard of Grand Coulee Dam. Well, coulee is the local term for these enormous flood channels. And as some of you know, features like this have been found on Mars as well, and that's one of the great puzzles about our understanding of Mars, because liquid water cannot exist there today even so much in quantity, even so much as a drop. This is the Columbia River, which is the only major river that runs across this area now, and the center line runs right about through there, and as I mentioned, the north edge runs through this part. Then you run into the Rockies. We're going to skip the Rockies, magnificent though they are, for other purposes. We don't want to be there, as you can see from those clouds. But to the east of the Rockies, again, this is in Montana. Great Falls, Montana is in there somewhere, and the center line runs through about there. To the east of the Rockies, there is, again, lots of flat land, low-lying land, in their precipitation shadow, and that is probably the other good location to be, either in the precipitation shadow of the Rockies or the precipitation shadow of the Cascades. And this is the Great Plains, which consists of material eroded off the Rockies. The Rockies are only 65 million years old, which is young for mountains, but water is so powerful in erosive agent on this planet that already more material has been eroded off them than is still left on them. And much of that material was eroded off by rivers which were not able to make it all the way to the Mississippi and into the Gulf. And so they simply flowed through this semi-arid region, because it is in the precipitation shadow of all those mountains, and dropped the sediment wherever they happened to end. And that went on and on and on, and you have a sheet of this stuff, hundreds of feet in thickness, which is the Great Plains, and it tapers off very, very slowly towards the east. Here is a scene just to the east of what you just saw. I think you can see it's flat and monotonous, and in general, it's the kind of thing that you want to drive across and get the heck out of as fast as possible for most purposes, but for the eclipse, it may be just what you want. Finally, the eclipse track goes up through North Dakota. Here is a scene almost on the center line. The eclipse track runs through like this, and this is the Turtle Mountains, which are an erosional remnant of the same Great Plains material. By now, you're far enough east that younger rivers, such as the Souris River here, have taken away most of the Great Plains material, which still is in existence farther west. But this is an island of the stuff that is still west, and it's a little bit higher, and so it is wooded. That line right there is, believe it or not, the boundary between the United States and Canada. Remember how when you were a kid somebody had to tell you that countries are not really different colors, they just make them that way on a map? Not so. They are really different colors in many places. Different logging practices, for example, in the north and in the south. We clear cut, the Canadians don't. They have a national park on the Turtle Mountains, we farm it. At least we farm some of it. And another thing that you can see here, which is quite remarkable, is these swampy areas. You want to stay away from them. Those could have fog, and remember the sun is going to be pretty high in the sky. Those are the remnants of Glacial Lake Souris, which was something that formed toward the end of the last ice age, lasted for a while there, and is now completely gone. Rather like the Great Lakes, except that it doesn't exist anymore. Lake Winnipeg and Lake Manitoba, both of which are in the eclipse track, are the same sort of thing as the Great Lakes, only they still exist. And they are just tiny remnants of Lake Agassiz, which was as big as all of the present Great Lakes put together. It's incredible the amount of changes that have gone on in just the last few tens of thousands of years. Finally, the eclipse track goes into to Hudson's Bay. Here is a distant view of Hudson's Bay in the winter, Skylab 4, and the eclipse track runs right across there, and I think you can see that's not the part of the world where you want to go. So much for the solar eclipse. Let me briefly show you some pictures of a lunar eclipse now. These pictures were taken every 10 minutes at an eclipse that happened in 1968. And this is a portion of, this is the very beginning of it, this is all penumbral darkening. You can see the later stages of the penumbral eclipse, when the moon is, when part of the moon, one edge of the moon is getting close enough to the umbra that the penumbral darkening is significant, you can see the penumbral darkening as a slight brownish shade over part of it. I apologize for this, it's damage on the slide, but what you're supposed to look at is over there anyway. Of course, for this photograph, they had to overexpose the light portion of the moon apart in the outer penumbra, and it was clear the penumbra. This is the exact beginning of totality, and you can see that by now, the penumbral darkening is quite obvious. It appears as a brownish wound at the edge of the moon. In our eclipse, it will appear as seen from Detroit or seen from southeastern Michigan right up at the top of the edge, top edge of the moon. Every 10 minutes, moving into the umbra. Now here is a long exposure which just barely begins to pick up a little hint of the light in the umbra. You'll see that better in a few moments. Back to the normal exposure. Edge of the umbra just about crossing the Apollo 15 site. Now here comes a picture taken at the same moment as this one. I'm sorry. Here comes a picture taken at the same moment as this one. There we go, with a longer exposure. And now the umbral part is completely, the penumbral part rather, is completely overexposed. But I think you see what I mean about this beautiful reddish glow in the umbra. You'll be able to see that quite clearly with the naked eye. Binoculars are best for a lunar eclipse. This is a poor man's astronomical event. Telescopes are actually poorer for it than binoculars. And the reason for that is that they magnify the image too much and they dilute these faint colors. Another picture. See, we're still not into totality yet. And this is taken with the same exposure as those other, the earlier series, the short exposure. Now here is a picture at the exact beginning of totality. In this particular eclipse, there happened to be a bright star close to the moon. In fact, you will be able to see the moon's orbital motion, not only as it moves through the umbra looks like this, so you can watch it move along its orbit as it goes through the umbra. You'll also be able to see it go over that star. This is a picture taken just about the same moment with a wider field of view. Those stars are in the constellation Pisces. Middle of totality. Shortly after this, in our eclipse, the moon will have set for Detroit. This is the end of totality. You can see the moon has now covered the star, and notice how it's now at the other part, the other side of the umbra. See, in that first picture, it was over there. So it went through the northern portion of the umbra, and the darkest part was on the southern edge. And here is a picture of the whole thing. These pictures are every 7 minutes. Here is a continuation of that series with dawn coming on, hinting at the kind of thing that you can do at this eclipse if you photograph it in Detroit. But I'll bet you can do a more imaginative job of choosing a foreground. In fact, in an urban area, you can get some interesting looking buildings that are lighted up. And so for once, you know, it's better to be in the city than the country for an astronomical event. Okay, if I can have, no, I guess I want the overhead projector again. You might as well turn the room lights up, at least somewhat though, for this one, because that is the last of the slides, and I'm going to kill myself if I try to. That's good. Why don't you leave me about there? For the final thing, what I want to do is give you some information on all of these eclipses, as they will be seen from Detroit. Here is the schedule for a lunar eclipse. The penumbral eclipse begins at 4:20.2. I'm giving it to you to the nearest tenth of a minute. And that is a theoretical item. That is not something you're actually going to be able to see. You may begin to see penumbral darkening somewhere around 5 o'clock, and it will appear just about at the top edge of the disk. The partial eclipse begins as the moon just touches the umbra, again at the top edge of the disk, at 5:17.9. Morning twilight, this is astronomical twilight, there are several different definitions of it, at 5:24 a.m. The total eclipse begins at 6:31.3. The middle of the eclipse is 6:54.2. Sunrise is 7:03 and moonset is 7:05. The reason they're not the exact same moment, I mean, the moon is supposed to be opposite the sun at an eclipse, right? But the reason that the moon doesn't set at the exact moment the sun rises is partly atmospheric refraction, that is, the atmosphere bends the light from them, keeping the sky a little bit later, but also because of the way we define them. Sunrise is defined not as the moment when the middle of the sun is on the horizon, but as the moment when the top edge of the sun is far enough into the sky that for it to travel far enough into the sky to go from top edge on the horizon to middle of the horizon. Okay? Likewise, moonset is defined as the moment when the last bit of moon disappears below the horizon. Again, top edge on the horizon. And it takes 1 minute for the moon to travel from center of the horizon to top edge of the horizon. Okay, when you've had enough time to copy these data, I'll run ahead to the other one, which is the partial eclipse as seen from Detroit. And this is going to be of interest only to those of you that have safe filters, and so I imagine. In fact, tell you what, why don't I run forward to that now, let those who are interested copy it, and then I'll come back. I'll simply weave on the lunar eclipse data. The partial eclipse as seen from Detroit, here I'm giving you the nearest second, not just the nearest tenth of a minute. The partial eclipse begins at 10:44 and 18 seconds in the morning, and the first little notch will appear at the edge of the sun at about the 2:30 position. If you think of the edge of the sun as, if you think of the sun as being like a clock, okay, with 12 o'clock up and 3 o'clock due right, it'll be almost due right. The maximum eclipse will be only 1 minute and 8 seconds after noon. In fact, in Ann Arbor, it's even more incredible than that. Maximum eclipse is exactly 6 seconds before noon. So it'll be a pretty easy matter to remember when it is. And at that maximum eclipse, 80% of the diameter of the sun will be covered by the moon, which means 75% of the area of the sun will be blocked by the moon. If you want to go through the geometry, you'll find that so. And it ends at 1:19 and 28 seconds p.m., and the last little notch is going to be at the 10:30 position, roughly. Okay, let me run back now to the lunar data. And one thing that I forgot to mention explicitly when I was reading all that to you is the location on the horizon where the moon will set, as seen from Detroit or anywhere in southeastern Michigan, is the point that is 9.5 degrees south of due west. You can estimate 9.5 degrees very closely by first finding out where due west is. And pretty easy to do that because so many of the streets and roads in Michigan run east, west, and north, south. Okay, so shouldn't have any trouble finding out which way to due west in your particular location. And then hold out your clenched fist at arm's length, and you will find that from one edge to the other covers exactly 10 degrees of sky, incredibly enough. One of the most remarkable coincidences that I know. And it's amazing how few people know that. I have astonished all kinds of professional astronomers by telling them that. You know, it's not even some weird number like 12.369 degrees of sun. It's for the total eclipse at the highest place. I told you that it was 26 degrees. Okay, you go to the old choosing upside routine. Put the bottom of one fist at eye level, that's the horizon. Usually you can't see the theoretical horizon, but just put the bottom of one fist at eye level, and then that's 10 degrees, there's 20 degrees. You got to practice this for about 20 seconds, and you'll have it for the rest of your life. Why you have to practice it is there's a tendency, the very first time you try it, to move the fist, it's supposed to be stationary. But as soon as you learn to hold that still, and you know, it's not a very difficult skill to learn, then there's 20 degrees, and 4/10 of the next one is 24 degrees, and so it's going to be way up there. You've got a built-in texture in your own body. Try it out. See if it doesn't take exactly 9 fifths to go from the horizon to the overhead point. Go ahead. Don't tell anybody. Come on.
Very useful kind of thing to know. If you ever want to report something you should see in the sky, whether you think it's a quote UFO end quote or not. Very important to express where it is in the sky. People try to do it by saying things like, oh, it looked about 2 inches above the moon. You know, and they sort of chuckle apologetically and they say, well, of course, I don't really mean 2 inches. You know what I mean. No, I don't know what they mean. It turns out that one person's idea of what 2 inches means in that sense is not the same as another's. What they're trying to express is it was so and so many degrees above the moon, and if they just knew this simple trick, they'd be able to do it. So, I don't know, if you're not going to go to the Pacific Northwest and see this eclipse, that may be the most useful thing you learned from this whole lecture. But in any case, well, okay, that's let's throw it open to questions at this point, and thank you very much. Now, I remind you about all these maps that are down here. Oh, people, before you go, important announcement. Sorry, I almost forgot. First of all, this is not the important announcement. First of all, we have our same handouts from the last several weeks out there in the back. So if you missed them or if you want another copy, you got one more chance. Secondly, this is the important announcement. Tom Heppenheimer's Space Colonization book is in upstairs at the gift shop, but there are only about a dozen copies. And all of them have been earmarked for people that signed up. There is a sign-up sheet. You can give your name and your phone number for either that book or the paperback of either the Heppenheimer or the O'Neill book, and they will let you know when it comes in, and they'll save it for you, and priority will be given to those that did sign up. So let's let people give people a chance to leave who want to, and then we'll pass on to those of you that have questions. Yeah, I recommend the hardcover of Heppenheimer because the pictures are so good, but the paperback of O'Neill. People, one thing I should ask you, please don't get your hands on the map. The reason is that I did all the drawing with Felkit marker, which is water soluble. So you'll smear it if you get perspiration on it. Also, don't cry on it or drool on it. I realize it's a beautiful map, but don't drool all over it for me. Okay, question here.
What do you have going on Friday in Ann Arbor or anything?
Nothing happening in the Astronomical Film Festival until May.
Until May.
Yeah. We won't have programs in May. I know there's a new comet in the morning sky, Comet Bradfield, and I spent almost all day Saturday doing calculations about it because I'm writing a column on the naked eye sky for the Ann Arbor Observer, and finally, after all of that work, came to the realization that it was going to be a very, very uninteresting object for almost everybody. For a real space freak, you know, a real astronomy freak, yes, but it won't be visible to the naked eye. There is no way. Brightest magnitude is going to be its fourth magnitude, and that is if it were at the zenith, you know, and most of the time it won't even be that.
And that's for a star, too.
That's
very I blew it. There is a gentleman who had a very important announcement, and for those of you who are still left, I'll ask him to make it. I'm sorry. Is he here?
I'm still here.
Okay. Sorry. This is the hardcore, though, so these are the ones you wanted.
Okay. I'm sorry. There's a few of us that have been talking about getting together and discussing further the idea of space utilization, industrialization, colonization. We've got a pad back there with a pencil. Anybody that would like to do so, leave your name and address, and we'll get in touch with you. Okay? Thank you, Jim.
You bet. Thank you.
For the Come.
Question.
We are members. Thank you. I really enjoyed these.
I'm glad you did.
Lectures.
Thank you. Yeah, and if you pass that on to Cranbrook, I'd appreciate it because they were the good people that invited me.
You didn't mention next Thursday. Landing.
I didn't mention next. Well, you know, the schedule's out there. Yeah.
Why have you
canceled out any possibilities of being in Canada here, or let's say Brandon or Winnipeg for that?
Because it's February. Look,
yeah,
I'm totally.
They've said that they've got a 50-50 percentage too there.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, I am very ignorant of Canadian geology, meteorology, you name it. My information stops at the border because, you know, you get it by country. And if Winnipeg is or Brandon is a reasonable area, well, fine.
It's right on the center line. And I've been informed that it's 50-50.
Really? Well, that's about the best you can do, 50-50. But I imagine there's micrometeorology too. For example, in these summertime eclipses, you want to be on the shoreline opposite the sun of some small body of water, like a lake, so that you don't have cumulus clouds over the lake, you know, and the lake inhibits the formation of cumulus clouds in the afternoon especially. And there's going to be all kinds of considerations like that, even within a geographic area. So I didn't worry too much about giving, you know, specific advice as to where to go. The important thing that I said about advice of where to go is read Sky and Telescope every month from now on, from now through the eclipse.
I was interested in the record, the one with the Mighty spacecraft.
Yes.
Is there a record player of some sort that goes with it, or are those instructions?
Well, okay, I have gone through this before, but briefly, the instructions show how to use, what is on the spacecraft is the record and a needle and cartridge. Okay, and the theory is that any extraterrestrial civilization which is clever enough to find that thing in the first place is going to be clever enough to figure out what to do with it, given that much of a hint plus the picture. So there is not an entire phonograph, but there is enough that they should be able to figure it out.
I wanted to know if you could tell if the Earth was wobbling or tilting its axis. Would an astronomer be able to show that or know that it was happening?
Well, the Earth's axis is tilted by 23.5 degrees and always has been. I can't think of anything that would change it significantly. There are minor changes in that all the time. For example, every spring when the snow melts and the rivers and the water runs down to the ocean, you know, some of which is toward the equator where the snow was not, that constitutes a change in the mass distribution of the Earth, which actually produces a very slight change in the Earth's rotation axis. But those effects are very, very tiny. And other than that, the answer is no. See, you have, if you know about the gyroscopic effect, which stabilizes a rotating object, the Earth is an enormously massive object. So you have a just phenomenal gyroscopic effect. And the only thing that could seriously change the obliquity, which is the tilt of the axis of a planet, would be, well, either a really major change in the distribution of mass. For example, it's been suggested there was such a change when the great volcanoes developed on Mars, and those are enormous piles of rock. Even that is kind of dubious. Or else, a catastrophic meteorite impact, and it would be hard to arrange one that was big enough without destroying a planet. You know, so, you know, barring the faint chance of something of that sort, the answer would be no mass. Yeah, but we have all I can say is if so, you know, I've certainly never heard it. Where did you read it? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's actually a tilt in the orbit with respect to the axis rather than the other way around. So I didn't understand, you know, if you, the way you phrased it, you said the axis, and yeah, it's actually a change in the orbit rather than the axis itself. It's the orbit that's wobbling back and forth. No, the angle of the obliquity is measured with respect to the plane of the ecliptic, which is the plane of the Earth's orbit. So if that changes, then the angle is going to change, but it's not because the axis is changing, because what you're measuring with respect to is changing. Okay? Question here. There is no barber shop. There are three different types of Western popular music. One rock and roll, one jazz, and one, whatever you call that. Brian Joey Johnson is just, you know, he was doing a thing unto himself, and I don't know what genre name you would call it. Blues, perhaps, but it's not typical blues. There is no barber shop. No. Are you a member of the, with that long set of initials by any chance? Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Barbershop Quartet Singing in the United States? Just wondering. Hudson's Bay itself has never been suggested as being a meteorite crater. What you're thinking of is the Belcher Island arc on the east of it, which is not quite a semicircle, about 300 miles in diameter, the whole circle were there. It's circular, you know. We need more evidence than that. There is no evidence of shock metamorphism that I know of. There's no brecciation. There's no shatter film. So, you know, that's speculative. You can't disprove it, but I don't know of any evidence that forces you in the direction of believing it. There are lots of circular pictures on here. You know, Antarctica is circular. Only that's not a hole, that's a landmass. You know, there's a circle. Oh, let's see. How about one over there? Let me take one along the side.
Reading for like
with the recommended reading, except for space colonization, and of course I've told you a lot about those books, the answer is unfortunately no. There's just so much of this material that just is not available in any convenient place.
Are there any journals that are good for space shuttle?
Space shuttle? Yeah, Aviation Week. And Science News is excellent, also. Not so much for the space shuttle, although it certainly talks about it, as for things like planetary results, planetary mission results, that sort of thing.
Well,
that's
a good question. My state representative for information on space shuttle.
Really?
And the
folks on
the government.
Fine. Oh, yeah, you can turn me right off the government printing office and ask, you know, send me a list of everything you have on the space shuttle. And there are some booklets and so forth. I don't think those booklets are even as detailed as my lecture. So, you know, what you want is more information, and I'm not sure that would help. But yeah, sure, there are a lot of good things. Miscellaneous sorts of things. But I don't know of anything that, you know, really sums up all the space shuttle material that you ever might want to know in one single convenient place at a level that is more detailed than I gave you already, which is available to the public. You know, with all those qualifiers, the answer would be I don't know. Man. That chart, okay, the small scale chart that shows the entire eclipse path.
I mean, I'm talking about your first lecture, the one with the...
Oh, that bar chart?
Yeah.
You can, I made that myself. I can tell you where you get the data. You can make your own. It's not hard to make your own, just go to any Kansas bookstore or any graphic supply store, and they've got things now that you can just buy, and whether you have any graphing training or not, you can make your own charts. You can get bars that are in rolls, like rolls of scotch tape, and you cut it off at the right length, and you can get press-on lettering, you know, and with a little bit of practice, you can do that. But where you get the data is that every year, the U.S. Commerce Department puts out, well, every month they put out a magazine which is called Survey of Current Business. Okay, and that's in all the big libraries, and the file and the periodicals probably under S. And every July, the Survey of Current Business has a detailed statistical breakdown of the U.S. economy. And it'll tell you how much we spend on space, and how much we spend on shoes, and how much we spend on welfare, and how much we spend on tobacco, and you name it, it's all in there. Getting costs of individual missions, you'd have to look in, that's harder. You have to find, it appears in every doggone newspaper and magazine article at the time of the launch, you know, and usually well after. I mean, every article about Viking, time after time, didn't just say Viking, it was all, we saw $1 billion Viking program, you know, and so it's fairly easy to find if you just look in the New York Times News Index under Viking cost of, Pioneer Venus cost of, that kind of thing, but I can't give you a single convenient source for it the way I can for the non-space data. But of course, the Survey of Current Business July issue will have the NASA budget anyway. Question back there. Yeah.
I don't mean to get into deep, but at last lecture, you mentioned something about the red sky effect on Venus.
Yeah, and I never explained it. I'm sorry about that. And in fact, it's actually explained tonight. If you understand why the sky is red at sunset, or why the sky is red around the horizon during totality, simply a matter of the light has to travel through a lot of air, and as it goes, the blue light gets scattered out and red light remains. But he got it, because even overhead, the light is traveling through an awful lot of air on Venus. So all to get through is the red. And you have this deep crimson appearance of the landscape all the time. Carl Sagan is fond of pointing out, Venus exactly matches the classical medieval description of hell. You know, lurid red illumination, unbearably hot, choking atmosphere, sulfurous fumes, weird landscape, strange optical effects. The only thing that's missing are little creatures with pitchforks. Those do not show up in here better than 9 or 10 pictures. But of course, those only cover a small part of Venus.
How do you explain
an object will not burn on the surface of the sun because burning constitutes combustion. That is to say, burning constitutes oxidation. That is to say, the combination of atoms into molecules. And on the sun, the temperature is so hot that molecules bang together so hard. Temperature is a measure of how fast the molecules or atoms that the gas is made of are moving. They bang together so hard that they break apart. You just don't have molecules on the sun, with the exception of about a dozen very, very hardy, very, very simple ones. For example, titanium oxide. And, you know, it's not burning very much titanium on the sun, even though that is an oxide. Okay, let's take somebody ahead and take it before we come back to you.
I got two related questions.
All right.
First, what is the makeup of the solar wind?
The solar wind is made of the same stuff the sun is, because it is material from the sun.
And secondly, on the Apollo 11 mission...
I said the solar wind is made of the same stuff as the sun, and somebody said, oh no! maybe it was unrelated. Okay. I'm going to go fluid, I want to know.
On the Apollo 11 mission, they had a part of the LSAT was a solar wind collector.
Yes.
Have you seen anything?
That wasn't part of the LSAT, in fact, but yes, they said a solar wind collector.
Did you see any results or findings on that?
Yeah, they were published in the Moon issue of Science in December of 1969. Basically, you know, it's made of what the sun is made of. I mean, the results were exciting if you happen to be a specialist in solar physics, but they were not unexpected. We got about the amount they expected of about the materials they expected. But, you know, it's pretty exciting to be able to collect material from the sun. And, in fact, the Moon has material from the sun embedded in its soil, as rock. You know, the solar wind comes down, slams into the surface of the moon at 300 miles a second, and those gas atoms get embedded right in the surface. And so you have, you didn't really need to take a solar wind collector in a sense. You just collect rocks and you got it. And since the rocks are different ages, you can find strata on the moon. Oh, not due to sedimentation as on the Earth, but due to other things, a layer that is thrown out by a particular meteorite impact, for example. You've got dated samples of the sun from at least the last billion years of solar system's history in the lunar samples that we have now. There must be still older ones that are still out there that we'll be able to go back and get someday. A museum of samples of the sun from throughout the history of the solar system, preserved for us. Just waiting for it.
You were talking about the conditions on Venus, and you said stuff about weird optical effects.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember something?
The weird optical effects are due to the fact that the air is so dense that a horizontal light ray wouldn't remain horizontal, it would actually bend.
Yeah, I seem to remember reading in some book that theoretically you could see around Venus like twice.
Theoretically you could see around Venus an infinite number of times if the air were perfectly clear, perfectly transparent, I mean. But it's not. It would scatter the light. So in practice you wouldn't. But you can send radio waves completely around Venus and you don't need an ionosphere to bounce them off. Venus, in fact, does have an ionosphere. But the radio waves would bend simply in the air in the same way as the light would, and radio waves actually would go completely around the planet. That, in fact, is how the effect was discovered in the first place. It's called superrefractivity. Superrefractivity is the condition in which a horizontal light ray bends at a curvature equal to or greater than the curvature of the planet itself, okay, so that it could, in principle, go completely around. And Venus's atmosphere is super refractive below a height of 15 miles, I think. Oh, can I question? You had one a while ago.
Well, on the second round?
I guess so. Yeah. Go ahead.
I have a couple of questions I'm getting asked.
Okay.
The Kumar moon surface is within the Roche limits.
No, neither.
Are they outside the Roche?
Yes. The only natural moons that are within the Roche limit are very tiny objects because they've broken up. Those are the rings of the particles that make up the rings of Saturn and the particles that make up the rings of Uranus.
But I thought they were within 2.5 times the diameter of the planet. Are they within 20,000 miles of the planet?
20,000 miles may be the Roche limit for Earth.
It's not
the moon for Mars.
Right.
Yes, but it depends. I just don't remember what the Roche limit of Mars is, but Phobos is just barely outside.
Well, they claim that 2.5 times the diameter of the planet roughly is the Roche
limit.
It could be within that
tower. 2.5 times
the diameter of the planet.
That doesn't ring with the diagrams that I've seen of where the Roche limit for Saturn is, for example.
Well,
depends on the density of the object. The one
I would think so, but in December issue of the Astronomy magazine, that it's just 2.5 times.
2.5 times? All I say is that one of the Viking boom experts, Martin Boone experts, was asked this question specifically at a press conference. And he said, no, Fogel is just barely outside the earth limit. There was a suspicion there that the cracks that have been found, parallel grooves that have been found along Fogel, might have been actually due to incipient breakup by approaching the earth limit. But that theory is out this year because all those cracks seem to be quite old. They all have a fair number of meteorite craters along in the very, very close-up pictures of Phobos that have been taken by the orbiters. And you would expect that there'd be some recent ones that, if this was happening. So, I don't inform you right offhand, but I have to do a very terrible thing in science, and that is fall back on authority. Correct on that, sir.
Yeah, I have a second question.
Okay.
It appears that there is no other liquid water in our solar system.
Well, on the surface, apparently not. Ganymede, the third big moon of Jupiter, the fourth if you count all of them, and the biggest moon of Jupiter, is apparently made of mostly of liquid water on the inside, with an ice crust.
But still hasn't been established when we get these voyagers out there to take a closer look. But does it occur to you?
What we know about Ganymede is its density. And from the density, you can say that it's probably, from the density and what you know about cosmic chemistry and what substances are common and so forth, you can say that Ganymede is mostly water, more water than rock, in some form. Theoretical calculations about how much rock there would be and how much radioactivity would be in that rock, and the rate at which the body the size of Ganymede would heat up and cool off, would indicate that water would have mostly melted. So you're right, we don't know that Ganymede is liquid water on the inside. We know there's water of some sort.
But it appears then that the two basic stages of matter in our solar system tend to be liquid, solid and gas, and the liquid stages.
That's right. Liquids are very rare in astronomy in general. And there are two reasons for that. First, you need a certain amount of pressure for it. You know, if you have a low pressure environment like the moon where there's no air, or even Mars where there's very little, you just don't have liquids. Second, if you look at almost any substance, the range of temperatures in which it is a liquid is very small compared to the total range of temperatures that exist in the universe. Now,
what kind of liquids would you think would fit on any Christian annual eclipse
at all? It depends, of course, on where the space colony was, but if you're talking about an orbit between the Earth and the Moon, you'd have a total eclipse. And in fact, I showed a nice painting by Don Davis of exactly that. It's a total eclipse of the Sun by the Earth. Seen from the side of space colony. If you miss that, grab a look at Tom Heppenheimer's book, I'm pretty sure it's reproduced in there.
Yes,
hi.
I get a surface of the sun, and I the impression that I've seen pictures of the surface of the sun in gigantic shots of flames streaming up.
Well, you're talking about prominences, and as I mentioned, those are not flames, although some of them bear a superficial resemblance to flames. Most of them, in fact, do not. Look at a real flame next time you get your fireplace going, and take out a picture of a prominence and look at it side by side, and you'll find there's not really very much resemblance.
What were the prominences?
We don't really know what they are. They're extensions of the chromosphere. They're cooler than the chromosphere itself, but not all that much cooler. And they're apparently all about magnetic fields, but what causes them, what maintains them, what determines the exact shape they have, all that kind of stuff, this is the sort of detail that we just don't know enough solar physics yet to be able to answer. A lot of things about our nearest star that we don't know. In fact, I'm impressed by the fact that the more we learn about the one star where we can see lots of detail, we've got all these mysteries, and what are the others going to turn out to look like when we finally get to the point where they're more than just dimensionless dots of light in our best telescope? It's going to be very interesting to find out. We certainly got enough shocked about planets, and we all knew about planets. Okay, and on that particular note, we're going to have to call it a series, and I thank you very, very much for your interest, and I hope I hear you. Thank you.